needle exchange programs have had a controversial history, and it was in January 2008 that three people were arrested in San Antonio for running an underground needle exchange program. The trio were working out of the St. Mark's Episcopal Church. They were charged by the district attorney at the time with possession of drug paraphernalia. What they were doing now is actually legal. We're working towards having a fully legal needle exchange program here in Bexar County. And with that program, with the launch of the program, it's going to have to come some public awareness, some education of the public of what this does, how this works, and how you benefit, whether or not you're part of the addicted community or not. You can call in with your questions and comments, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this hour by Colleen Bridger, Assistant City Manager for the City of San Antonio. Dr. Bridger, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
TJ Mays is here, Chairman of the Bexar County Opioid Implementation Task Force. TJ Mays, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
And Pastor Joe Barber's here. He is with St. Luke's Baptist Church, and he is the he has been involved with needle exchanging for quite some time here in Bexar County and in San Antonio, but not always on the books, right?
Exactly. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
All right. So, first of all, Colleen Bridger, what is the status of the needle exchange program?
So from a legal perspective, it's completely legal and we're able to do it in Bexar County. From a financial perspective, the commissioner's court allocated funding for us to be able to purchase supplies that are needed in order to begin operating an above ground needle exchange program.
Okay, so we're going to be getting into what was going on and why was this operating in the shadows? So why does it have to do that? I want to remind our listeners that our number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. So TJ Mays, you're with the Opioid Implementation Task Force. How does having a needle exchange program fit with that?
Well, the growth in diagnoses for hepatitis C and HIV from intravenous drug use have gone up with the opioid epidemic. So we had the first wave of the opioid epidemic, which was prescription pills, which led to more needle drug use, and we've seen the spread of disease for that. The legal authorization for needle exchange is within the context of a disease prevention and control program. So we really are marrying dual policy objectives of addressing the opioid epidemic, increasing treatment, but also preventing the spread of disease.
Pastor Joe Barber with St. Luke's, tell me about what you've been doing.
Well, for the past over 20 years, I've been involved in individuals that have been actively shooting drugs intravenously, and we just saw a need to address that situation. At the church where I reside, where I pastor in the neighborhood and on the west side of San Antonio, in the community, I've seen needles in the ground or in trees or in different sources that needed to be retrieved and disposed of. From the years of doing HIV outreach work, I know of individuals that would approach me with hopes of assessing treatment or needing clean syringes. So we felt the need to be able to address that and be able to help them without, one, going to jail, and two, harming them. So that's been our continuous work for the past 20 years in trying to assist an individual from going from active using to full recovery as best as possible.
So what do you mean they were in the trees, like in the crook of a tree?
In the crooks of the trees, good hiding spot, good spot to place your equipment, because you didn't want to walk around with the paraphernalia on you, so you would leave it in the crook of the tree and then come back later to retrieve your supplies when you needed to do what you needed to do.
But if you're a kid and you like to climb trees,
you're in trouble. You might prick yourself. You might stick yourself. You might, out of just curiosity, pick it up and stick somebody else. It's a possibility. Well, it's a real thing that can happen. Or it's just on the ground behind a rock or whatever. If those are realities that happen all the time. What happened, a lot of pastors in the area, or a lot of people in the area, would come to me and ask me how to dispose of those syringes, those needles, because they would find them around their locations, their churches, and didn't have Sharps containers or ways to dispose of those. So I became kind of the drop-off spot or the person to go to because of the fact that I had been involved in HIV community for so many years.
So the needles and the syringes, we call it needle exchange, it's really a syringe type thing. What kind of condition were they in? Could you tell that these had been used in sort of a rough manner?
Oh yeah, they've been used. They a lot of times they still had blood residue in them, or they were dirty. They might have had some water still in them from where they were. They had dirt on the tips because of the fact that they were in a tree or on the ground. So they were used. Sometimes it was bent and someone had tried to straighten it out. Sometimes the plunger was kind of messed up and carrying on. But the main thing that a person would try to get is get a good point to be able to do what they would have to do. And sometimes I would find people that would reinfect himself or infect themselves because they would find a syringe on the ground and they would be like, I need to do what I need to do, so I'll just use this because it's available and I don't have the money to go and purchase another one.
Because when a person is dope sick, when they need their dose, and they'll do whatever they got to do to deal with that, right? Is that the way? Have you seen that, Pastor Barber?
Bluntly, yes. That's a reality. It's a need based thing. If I need something taken care of, I'll do what I need to do to get it taken care of at that time. It doesn't matter about the cleanliness or anything of this nature. It's just that I have to take care of what I have to take care of. And I'll use whatever equipment or whatever ways to make it as safe as possible so I can continue to do what I need to do.
And the Colleen Bridger, can you talk about how, I guess, the county is behind this? Or is it Judge Wolf? Who's really your advocate in the courthouse?
One of the very first meetings I had when I came to the city of San Antonio was a meeting with Judge Wolf. And one of the topics of conversation in that meeting was the fact that the judge would very much like for us to figure out how to bring syringe services programming to Bexar County. And so we've been working with a coalition of individuals on how do we make this a reality. So Judge Wolf was certainly a champion, and Commissioner's Court voted to allocate this funding. And just to note that the way that the law is written, only Bexar County could fund syringe services programming for our residents.
Sure. So we'll talk about that when we come back from the break, but that was due to a carve-out that Representative Ruth Jones McClendon was able to get for Bexar County only. So being able to get this to work here, show the rest of Texas how it goes. This could be an example and help bring legal needle exchange to the rest of Texas, because I know they have it in Travis County and other parts of Texas as well. But it's under the radar. It's limited in how much good you can do. So let's talk about that when we come back from the break. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Have you seen a lot of these needles in parks and places? Wouldn't you like to see them go away? What are your concerns about having a needle exchange program here in Bexar County? 210-614-8980. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about a needle exchange program here in Bexar County. We're launching one, the county, the Metro Health is launching one with the city of San Antonio. It's the only here in Bexar County is this possible due to a carve-out that was made by Representative Ruth Jones McClendon, who we recently lost. And can you talk a little bit more about that, Colleen Bridger? Why is that important? How do you see that? Does it add more weight to if Bexar County has this ability to do it, then we should probably be working with that?
Yes, that's if we're the only county in the state that's allowed to do this above board, then we need to take advantage of that and we need to make sure that we run our program in a way that we can then report out the success of the program, which there are plenty of states and cities throughout the nation who run very successful syringe services programs. We have no doubt that it's an effective way to decrease communicable disease and, when people are ready, increase their access to treatment. So we know that we will see success. What we need to figure out how to do is how do we document that success without being overly burdensome on the providers of the service.
And TJ Mays, what type of outcomes are y'all looking for? What numbers will y'all be looking at?
So the Bexar County Opioid Implementation Task Force is going to consider that at a meeting in 2 weeks. I'll tell you what I'd like to see. We'd like to collect as many used needles as possible. Pastor Barber was talking about needles in public places. I'm looking at a study right now out of Miami that showed there was a dramatic decrease in the number of needles, used needles in public places when they implemented a syringe services program. We want to distribute sterile needles. We want to refer people to testing for communicable diseases, and we want to refer people to treatment. That's where the Opioid Task Force comes in. Rise Recovery, Alpha Home, and Lifetime Recovery got a grant from the United Way where they're going to have an addiction crisis hotline where someone can call in and be kind of steered to whichever treatment is available to them given their circumstances and what capacity there is at the different programs. So we definitely want to bring those initiatives together. We want to distribute Narcan. It's the anti-overdose agent that can save lives and is saving lives here in Bexar County. And then, of course, we want to collect data, to Dr. Bridger's point. We want to understand more about the population that's being served by these programs. So those are the six primary objectives of the program from my perspective.
And Colleen Bridger, is there a kit that people will be getting with a number of things?
So I don't think we've completely worked that out, but typically in syringe services programs, there is a kit, and it includes clean syringes. It includes alcohol wipes for cleaning the skin. It will include oftentimes antibiotic ointment that people can apply after using the needle. Oftentimes it'll include condoms and other information that people need in order to understand where they can go to get HIV or hepatitis C testing, where they can go for treatment, and some basic wound care information. So I don't know, Pastor Barber, if your kits have anything
other
than
that.
Yeah,
what do you provide?
Basically the same thing that you're saying. We also include the Narcan now at the St. Luke Church where we hope to do is to be able to educate the person on how to use the Narcan, how to use the supplies, also information, as you mentioned, about recovery support services that they can use and utilize at the time, hygiene kit, some hygienal type of things in the little bag that we have give them. Basically all that you just mentioned, it would be included in that kit.
How many of those kits have you given out?
Oh, man. We usually have on Wednesdays, usually the days that we, the fourth Wednesday, it started out initially the fourth Wednesday of the month, and I'm usually averaging anywhere from 20 to 40 kits that I'm giving on those Wednesdays from individuals that would come to me specifically to be able to do. Each one of those kits would have 10 clean syringes in those kits. So if you're doing 20 to 40, you're looking at maybe 100 syringes that we're giving and receiving back. That's on the average right now, mainly because it's just word of mouth between myself and a team of individuals that work the streets, and someone comes and say, "Yo, Joe, I need to do this, I need to do that." I anticipate it probably going to be more now that it's something that's public knowledge. It may increase. It's now increased to where we'll be doing this every Wednesday at the church from 3 to 6 p.m. On every Wednesday, we'll be able to do that exchange. So I anticipate that number to increase. That's why we need to get with the record-keeping part and making sure that we keep the numbers and all those together to make this an evidence-based type of movement.
The number is 210-614-8980. What questions do you have about the county's plan to start a needle exchange program in order to help address the opioid crisis here in our community and also to limit the spread of HIV and Hep C in our community? Do you have any concerns? What do you think needs to happen to help people who are addicted to opioids? So Pastor Joe Barber with St. Luke's Baptist Church, I mean, I guess you were aware that in 2008 there were people who were arrested for distribution of clean needles, you know? You knew that, right?
Oh, yes, I knew that. It wasn't me. I didn't go to jail. but I was aware of that. I was aware of that.
So you knew there was a risk?
Oh, yeah. That's why today's the first day I'm publicly talking to you. I knew it was a risk. I knew it, and I saw it, and everyone knew it. It's just that... unfortunately, that situation happened to the individual. But then, too, fortunately, it kind of opened up people's eyes to what was going on. So it really wasn't, it was unfortunate, but it was very fortunate because now we're able to talk about what happened and why it happened. But that didn't stop the need.
Yeah, so these folks, I don't know what happened to their prosecution, if it was ever dropped. I'd like to find out. So they faced a fine of $2,000 and a possible year behind bars for doing, which was basically essential social work.
Yeah. Nothing happened. I'm not privy to the whole information of the case. I do know that they were arrested or a fine was given or a ticket was given, whatever the case may be. But I don't think that those individuals ended up going, spending a long length of time in jail or doing anything like that. I really don't know how that case turned out. But all I know is that the way that I was taught to do kept me from being involved in that type of thing.
So, Colleen Bridger, can you talk about, you know, as assistant city manager for San Antonio, but you're the former director of the health department, how the needle exchange program does reduce the spread of HIV and Hep C and other blood infectious diseases?
Sure. So the majority of hepatitis C cases are as a result of sharing needles. And Bexar County has a higher than the national average of hepatitis C rates of infection. And so we've got a double whammy going on there, right? We've got more Hep C in the community. We've got people who are sharing needles. So the risk of transmitting hepatitis C is increasing because we have a higher rate. So if we can stop folks from using somebody else's needle, then we can decrease the risk of hepatitis C transmission. HIV is not as high of a percentage of infections transmitted via needle sharing, but it's still a very definite risk. It's less than 10%, but it's still a risk. And again, we have higher rates of HIV than the nation, and so we need to do everything we can to reduce exposure to those communicable diseases, and syringe services programs is one way to do that.
TJ Mays, what does local law enforcement tell you about having a needle exchange program? Have they voiced concern? Are they in support?
Well, the office of Councilwoman Shirley Gonzalez has been working with the San Antonio Police Department, and Commissioner Justin Rodriguez and our task force has been working with the Sheriff's Office, and they're on board with this program. They understand that it's vitally important to improving the health and safety of our residents, so we haven't gotten significant feedback from them.
But anytime a law enforcement officer pats down somebody, they ask them, do you have anything in there in your pocket that's going to poke me? Mm-hmm. You know, you would want the officer would want clean needles rather than infected needles floating around in the community that they could be poked with, right?
Right, and that's one of the other things we see nationwide with syringe services programs is law enforcement support of these programs because it decreases risk to their personnel.
And but there's concern, I'm reading about around the country and some of the blowback that some of these programs have established is that people are concerned that this causes a congregation of people to come together for at one location and increases crime or at a certain location. So is this going to be a point distribution, or does it go into the community to distribute? How does it work, Colleen Pritchard?
So our ultimate goal is to get it distributed in as many different places as possible. That's one of the things we're going to be working out, where exactly that is. But we're not going to have one central location. We're going to try to have multiple locations where people can get syringe services programming, as well as multiple locations where people can can turn in used syringes, because that is one of the biggest concerns that people have when they hear about, oh, you're going to be, you know, flooding the community with needles and there's just going to be more on the ground. The research actually shows the opposite. When people know that they have a source for clean needles, they're much more likely to dispose of the used needle in an appropriate location. So we want to make sure there are lots of appropriate locations where people can dispose of these needles.
So what's the best way to dispose of a needle like that?
In a sharps container.
If you don't have one?
If you don't have one, then there are a couple other options, but basically putting them in a hard plastic container with a lid, putting the lid on, and then putting that into a trash container.
I'm going to go to the phones with Eugene. Eugene, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I want to applaud the folks you have on today. I was going to ask, I know that they're doing the medical end of it, but I want to find out if they're issuing any psychological help to them, self-help books, things like that.
All right, Eugene, thank you for that. So Colleen Bridger, but this is a point of contact that where people can get access to services. Some of it is going to be mental health services.
The key tenet to syringe services programs is you meet people where they are and you give them what they need when they need it. And when you do that, you start to build a relationship with them where they trust you, so that when they're ready to start having conversations with you about the fact that they do want to seek help, they know to go to you and say, I'm ready to have this conversation. What do I need to do? And so, yes, a really important component of syringe services programs is having those resources available when folks are ready to have that conversation.
And TJ Maze, people can find a recovery help through a needle exchange.
Yeah, so the pilot addiction crisis hotline that United Way is funding in partnership with several of our partners will be a great way for people to find the help they need. So we're definitely building that into the program as a key pillar.
If a person has no insurance, no sort of income, what are their options for finding recovery?
So one of the issues, Dr. Bridger and I have been working on this for 2 years, and one of the issues is that different treatment providers have different financial criteria, age criteria, gender criteria, and so on. So the hotline is going to help people navigate through a series of questionnaires and sort of a large map flow chart of what are they going to be available, what's going to be available to them, and the Addiction Crisis Hotline is going to help solve that particular problem.
But there are services available now for people who really have no insurance and stuff.
There are services. They're limited. We wish there were more, but there are services available, and having this navigation system will help people more easily access it.
All right, we're talking about the needle exchange program getting off the ground now here in Bexar County. We really want to hear your stories. What have you observed in and around San Antonio with addiction? This is just another way of trying to help San Antonio deal with the opioid crisis, harm reduction, as well as dealing with the overall public health that they interlap, they intersect. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Call in with your questions and comments. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Needle exchange programs have been in existence for a long time in other parts of the country. They have proven to help deal with issues of public health, reducing the spread of HIV and Hep C, but for as long as anyone can remember, they've been prohibited in Texas, but there is a carve-out for Bexar County, and finally now Bexar County is able to establish a legal needle exchange program. We're seeing how that's happening now. Have you come in contact with needles? Have you seen them in public parks? Have you wondered, why do these things exist? What can we do to get rid of them? Have you had a loved one experience opioid addiction and abuse? Have you gone through recovery? What has worked for you? We want to hear your story. You can be anonymous. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. So there are a lot of myths and misconceptions that people have when you say we're going to start a needle exchange program. And Colleen Bridger, one of them I've heard, people think that you're supplying the drugs as well. So is that happening?
No, we are not supplying the drugs.
Okay, good. That's on the record, okay? Why do you think people believe that? So Pastor Joe Barber with St. Luke's Baptist Church, people have a lot of fears about this program coming into their neighborhood. Why do you think that is?
Well, you don't know. You just have lack of knowledge and what you envision what the an addict is or what the addiction is and all these things that may not even be real come into play. It's only when it becomes a little bit more personal. There's a story behind the user. There's a story behind the needle. When you start seeing that these people are they're a family to somebody. They're somebody's father, somebody's brother, somebody's mother, somebody's sister. They belong to somebody. And when you start personalizing in that way, it's only the right thing to do. And whatever myths or whatever fears are become minimal when you start seeing the reality.
And people are also, another myth is that you're supplying the location where people can do the injection. Is that happening?
Never have. What has happened is that we've provided a location where someone can get help. They only seek out the help that they need. A person's not going to waste their time coming somewhere if they're not going to get what they need. When showing up. So providing a location or providing a source is really for what that need is specified. So it's never been where someone will come and say, okay, I can use right here, or this is a place for me to get high. No, it's been used specifically for the need that they need at that time, whatever arises at that time. They may go use somewhere else, but they won't use at the place where they're getting the syringe.
The number is 210-614-8980. Let's go to Bonnie on the phones. Bonnie, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask if there's anything being done to increase treatment capacity, especially for, you know, the uninsured or underfunded people. Oh.
All right, Bonnie, great question. Thanks for calling in. T.J. Mays is with us. He's the chairman of the Bexar County Opioid Implementation Task Force.
So I absolutely agree that increasing treatment capacity should be one of our top priorities. We've seen more funding coming, frankly, from the federal and state governments. The opioid epidemic has been a dark cloud. There's been a lot of deaths, a lot of costs incurred by taxpayers in addressing it. But one silver lining is you're seeing a shift away from punitive measures toward rehabilitation. And you're definitely seeing that in the funding. But we do need more funding for the Center for Healthcare Services and other providers for lower-income residents. Another thing I'd say is that there's been a move to expand the use of what's called buprenorphine, which is a medication-assisted treatment. Physicians can only prescribe buprenorphine if they have a special DEA waiver. And the effort to expand the number of physicians with those waivers is right here at the Long School of Medicine, which we can see from this building. So expansion of medication-assisted treatment, expansion of treatment capacity in residential settings. We're seeing it slowly but surely, but we need all the support we can get to make it happen politically.
And let's go to another caller, Ariel. Ariel, welcome to The Source. Ariel, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just wonder, would there be a way to have a very, to ask the people who come in for the service, a very simple, non-judgment initial questionnaire, just a couple of three questions, trying to find out how did they get started onto the drug road. And perhaps after some time, the data could be aggregated and studied and perhaps might have some educational value down the line.
Ariel, great question. Thank you for that. Colleen Bridger, what kind of information gathering is going to be part of this process?
We are in the defining stages of what kind of information we'll be gathering.
But it will be anonymous? People will be able to...
Yes.
No questions asked?
No questions asked. You don't have to show an ID in order to get any services that we're offering. The question of why people become addicted to drugs is a really interesting question. It's really valuable for public health-minded folks who want to go as far upstream as possible and intervene. And I will say that based on the work that I did in North Carolina, the most common answer to that question is trauma. People who experienced trauma, either in childhood, adolescence, adulthood, look to soothe that pain by turning to drugs and alcohol. And if they are prone to addiction, then they are likely to become addicted to that soothing habit that they've created. But until they can really start to work out that trauma, they're going to continue to struggle with addiction for the rest of their lives.
Pastor Joe Barber with St. Luke's Baptist Church, and you have been interacting with folks who have been in the grips of addiction for quite some time. You host Wellness Wednesdays, and you deal with folks with care, with wound care, counseling. What's your observation about what do you think's behind this overdose opioid crisis?
It's a crisis now, but basically, I feel personally. We're gathering information. I think it's been a crisis for a long time. The situation the gentleman just asked, I feel that answering those questions has been is more of a relational type of thing. When you start talking to an individual, you'll find out that the trauma, as Dr. Bridger alluded to, they're more forthcoming and express it to you, the causes of them starting. But then as far as treatment, sometimes it may end up being in a progression of where a person would go from using $100 a day to $80 a day or maybe even $50 a day, or it may even decide to change the site of injection just to start improving their health on that basis, and then coming to the point of saying, I'm ready to go into treatment now that I'm able to sustain, or I've seen my life the quality of living to rise to the point that I'm ready to move forward. Sometimes that is, for me over the years, has been the one thing that's been continuous where a person may not be ready to go into treatment right at that time. Because back in the day when I first started, we would put people into treatment and they would be back on the streets before we even left the facility, because they didn't want to go through the pain of going through the detoxing thing. They weren't ready for that at that time, or they went in and detoxed it and they came back out and used again. So it was kind of a relational type of thing that built to where a person say, I'm ready, I'm at this point, let's go to the next step.
All right, let's go to the phones, 210-614-8980 with Lisa. Hi, Lisa, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I have a question and I have a comment. Listening to this, I've heard this happen in other cities and I was outraged. Mainly because I understand the needle exchange and that part. I guess I'm on board. I don't have an issue with that. But the whole Narcan distribution thing is very upsetting. I have had a sister directly impact every single person in our family because she's lost her children. So statistically, you can't rehabilitate these people. She's been doing it for years. She's never going to change, no matter what kind of services you offer. And what they do is they go out, they overdose, they get the Narcan, and they're back on the streets. There is no rehabilitation. Instead of putting the money into rehab for these people, why not put it in prevention? And the other comment is that, you know, on this board is somebody who probably does volunteer their time, but the other people get paid to create and keep the cycle going.
Okay, Lisa, thank you for calling in. I appreciate that. So TJ Mays, go ahead.
So one of the primary goals of our task force is to integrate prevention curriculum into the school districts. We've been meeting with various school districts and have been doing a lot of prevention work with evidence-based curriculum. So that answers that that comment, which I absolutely agree with you. The second is that when Narcan is administered by EMS personnel at the city, there's a peer recovery coach that goes and follows up with that person within 24 hours. This was an effort that we worked on the task force that Dr. Bridger co-chaired. Eric Walsh helped us with that. So we have an aggressive follow-up infrastructure in place. Once somebody's life has been saved with the Narcan, the San Antonio Council on Alcohol and Drug Awareness, peer recovery coaches go follow up with them and try and make them understand what resources are available to them, and that recovery is a track that they should think about.
Right, but we heard the pain in that caller's voice. She's another victim of the opioid crisis, even because it's impacted her life. And I don't know, in 30 seconds, Colleen Bridger, I mean, what do you think? I mean, how do we – it shows you that this is a major problem. It impacts lives.
It's a major problem for both the family and the person who's addicted. I'm not willing to write off anybody. And so when I look around at all of the people who are in recovery, who were able to figure out what was going on and how to fix it, I think there's hope for everybody out there. We just need to be able to connect them to the right resources at the right time.
We're taking a break. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're talking about the opioid crisis and needle exchange on The Source this afternoon. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about a needle syringe exchange program getting off the ground here in Bexar County, and also about the opioid crisis, where we continue to deal with here locally. And if you've got a question or comment, the number is 210-614-8980 from Gary on Twitter. Who else are y'all partnering with in the city, clinics, hospitals, and et cetera? TJ Mays?
So the program, as it's been conceived thus far, was developed with a partnership of the following entities: the Bexar County Department of Behavioral Health, the Bexar County Hospital District, which does business as University Health System, UT Health San Antonio, which has the medical school and the nursing school, and the Metropolitan Health District, as well as the various law enforcement agencies. So there's been a lot of work done with various government entities. We've also worked with Pastor Barber and his church, and also a nonprofit group called the Bexar Area Harms Reduction Coalition. So lots of partnership, which I'm sure you can imagine takes some time to get it all ironed out.
Right. So I'm still thinking about that caller we just had, and I can hear the pain, and it gets down to like the harm reduction. It's not the best choice that people have. So Pastor Joe Barber with St. Luke's Baptist Church, you've been seeing this for a long time. You can understand the anger from that caller. She's seen her loved one being torn apart by opioid addiction and then impacting the rest of the family and then the children. Harm reduction, is that enough?
No, it's not enough, but it's a part of the whole puzzle. The pain is real. It's painful to see your TV or see your appliances or whatever you value disappearing at an alarming rate. It's painful to see a loved one go through what they're going through and know that you love them, but it's no answer to that. So that's very painful. And then to suffer in your pain, you want to. You feel the need to lash out at something, you know, for your relief. Part of the harm reduction or part of the cycle is to understand that it's more than just the person that's using that's affected by this, but the family as well. So part of the whole program is that to be able to address the needs of the family. Maybe the family needs to be able to have a time to come to a place and talk about all my pain, all of my suffering. They have Al-Anon groups. They have Alateen, you know, they have different groups, support groups of family members that can be able to talk through or work through that pain that they're experiencing, because there's no real definite answer to that other than being able to share and receive support from that.
All right, let's go to Maria on the phones. Maria, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to address the fact that a lot of children are a lot of runaways, they're homeless, and even just anyone homeless is vulnerable to this type of situation, because a lot of addicts are homeless, and they sleep under the bridge together, they're in tents together, and tents, you know, as in camping tents, and I have firsthand experience with this situation. So I was a runaway at 11, and my two stepsisters, they were 10, and their sister was 8. And it just so happened that the friend that she was staying with, her father was a cab driver and a pimp, and my little stepsister was shot up with heroin, and she was used for prostitution at that little bitty age. And I was fortunate enough not to ever see such a thing. But, you know, I just wanted to bring that fact up that it's not all adults.
Yeah, Maria, thank you.
Little kids are vulnerable.
Maria, thank you for that call. So we have a lot of social problems. And for many people, they are all happening simultaneously. They're stacked one upon another. For people like Maria's story, you have a child who's being trafficked and poverty and other issues. So TJ Mays, it's not just opioid. If you're just dealing with opioid, that's enough. But unfortunately, all this is going on at the same time.
That's absolutely right. One of the ultimate goals long-term of the task force, in my view, is that we build a permanent infrastructure to address social problems with multiple government institutions. But the human trafficking is an issue. Councilwoman Villagran at the city has been a leader on this issue. The Opioid Task Force has worked closely with the Attorney General's office to achieve some legislative initiatives, and they're also working on human trafficking. So there are definitely players who are in the system who are addressing multiple issues, and just keeping everybody on the same page has been a vital objective.
And John, let's go to John on the phones. John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, one of the things I have seen in the past, being an addict myself, and one of the reasons why I chose not to participate in the needle exchange program, is because law enforcement would perch themselves up outside of this facility and then follow the individual away from the facility, pull them over, knowing that they just went to needle exchange, knowing that the possibility of them having narcotics on them is really high, and they used that as a tool, law enforcement did. And there were just so many of the people within the circle of drug users that I was involved in, we just stayed away from it because out of fear that that very same thing would happen to us.
All right, John, thank you for that call. And so Colleen Bridger, Assistant City Manager for the City of San Antonio.
That's why it was so crucial to us to have both the Sheriff's Office and the San Antonio Police Department's office on board with this before we rolled it out. Part of being on board with this means that they commit to not doing that very thing. We also have the DA's office that's completely supportive of this. And the DA's been doing a lot of really progressive changes in the office that leads to not prosecuting individuals with low-level drug possession. So I think that here in Bexar County, we're proactively addressing that concern to make sure that that isn't a barrier to people using this much-needed service.
Now, you can have great meetings with individuals who are high-ranking in SAPD, and then you go out on the street and you could, you know, have a different sort of reality. What is helpful is to have lines of communication open with people who are like John, who are in the addiction community, who can really report back about what's really going on. And is that possible?
It's not just possible. It's a requirement. It's imperative. And yes. And, you know, it's funny. It's been 2 years since I've been here working on this. Joe's been working on it for 20 years. Others have been working on it for a really long time. It feels to me like we're going really slowly, but one of the reasons why we're going as slowly as we are is to make sure that we have those relationships with all those folks who are, you know, boots on the ground doing this work day in and day out. First when it was underground, now that it's coming above ground, so that we do have those lines of communication open and can make sure that if there's one police officer or one sheriff's deputy that goes astray, we know about it immediately and we can fix it.
Let's go to Diego on the phones. Diego, welcome to The Source. Go ahead.
Well, hey, just want to say thank you for taking my call, and I applaud what you guys are doing. My uncle was an addict, which I don't have to use the word addict, but we got to treat these people more like patients now. There's mental health, a lot of pain behind their use. And I was going to piggyback on the previous caller, too, that I guess out of fear of turning into a user myself, what everything I saw as a youngster through my uncle or about him, you know, just using kind of deterred me from that road. But it was also, I can also tell as I grew up and I saw him pass away, it was I could tell there was a lot of pain, a lot of hurt. A lot of hurt. So I'm glad that everybody, from law enforcement to the religious aspect to the science aspect, as far as getting mental help, I just want to applaud everybody for doing it.
Diego, thank you for the call. I remember growing up and going to the park and seeing here in San Antonio, you know, the balloons, because, you know, that's where heroin was, in balloons, so, and then the needles and stuff scattered about. And the messaging I was getting is that this is happening all around me and that this is something that is not that far away from me. And if we have some sort of like programs like this and we're removing needles and from these areas and we're making it, not hiding it or covering it, but making it more distant from children, maybe it's not such a short walk for them to become addicted themselves. I mean, Colleen Bridger, what do you think?
So there's a lot of research out there that shows that when children are exposed to addictive behaviors, whether that be smoking, drinking, drug use, they adopt it as a cultural norm. And so it's not that difficult for them to think, well, a lot of people are doing it, it must not be that bad. So you're right. If we can remove those used needles and balloons from the daily lives of our children, then they're going to be less likely to see drug use as a cultural norm and less likely to use drugs themselves.
And TJ Mays, when is this going to be off the ground? When is this going to be full bore?
So my hope is that 1 month from today, we will be rocking and rolling. There are a few things that need to happen. The Opioid Task Force needs to agree on a set of metrics and accountability metrics, because we are using property taxpayer money. We do want to make sure that there's accountability tied to the expenditure of that money. That's very important to us.
Is $80,000, how long is that going to... That's what you got right now, right?
That's what we have for the fiscal year right now. It is a pilot program. We'll see how it goes, and we'll see if we need pilot program phase two. I think and hope we will.
And Pastor Joe Barber, I want to thank you so much for working as hard as you've done for so many years, taking these risks. I think it's an act of bravery. How do you feel now?
Well, I feel hopeful. I feel that it's about time. I believe that all things happen in God's time. I just think now.
I need to hurry up.
Point to go on. Let's do it. You know, time is now.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of our guests. Pastor Joe Barber, he's with St. Luke Baptist Church. You're all on Poplar Street, right?
1903 West Poplar Street.
All right. And Colleen Bridger, Assistant City Manager for the City of San Antonio. TJ Mays, Chairman of the Bexar County Opioid Implementation Task Force. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Rospiedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.